Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 295. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
I am with you, as always.
John Lindemann.
Absolutely, stupendously pleasurable to be here, Johnny.
Oh, Lord.
You just get more enthusiastic every week. And Guillaume Veillette.
I am psyched to be here.
I don't believe neither of you sound particularly psyched, or in John's case, absolutely, awesomely, greatly pleasured.
Well, I'm profoundly pleased to be here. And we have a great show this week. We didn't get through very much email last week because we kind of went on this crazy rant about E3. So we're going to do some more listener mail this week and try to catch up on some of our backlog. We got lots of interesting letters and questions to come up later in the show. And we got some details on the next retroactive feature also coming up at the end of the show. So look forward to that. But first up, we got new business, and Guillaume is going to kick it off.
Indeed. I've been playing a lot of Zen Pinball on my 3DS lately. It's the perfect game to go back to and to try to beat my old high scores. And yeah, like emphasis on try because I'm terrible at it.
But if it's your high score, shouldn't you be equally terrible then as you are now?
Well, sure, but yeah, like I can't seem to manage to even reach my old high score, and I've got friends on my friends list who really like wipe the floor with me. I got to do something about that.
New friends. That's what you do about it. New friends.
Yep.
I think I've got some decent scores on there. I haven't looked at yours, though. I need to. That's what friends are for.
There are some people from Negative World who are really incredibly skilled. But yeah, like the what brought this game back to my mind was doing the interview with Zen Studios at E3.
Yeah, it was a really nice job, by the way. People should go watch the video of you doing that interview.
Thank you. Thanks for doing the plug for me.
We have a whole segment for plugs, guys. Come on.
But yeah, like it was really fun. The first interview that I ever did, and I think it went well. Like the Zen Studios guys are really, really nice, and they've got Marvel Pinball coming the first week of July, and I'm really looking forward to that. I already have the tables, like the game from on PSN, but they're slightly different tables. I think they changed the Spider-Man one for the Captain America one. And it's going to be in 3D and portable, and I think that's probably, you know, the best reason to go get that version.
Yeah, this kind of game, portability is everything.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
I mean, especially having it, especially because it's a download game and it's just always on your system. And that's the best thing for me, because pinball is a game that I want to play for 10 minutes here and there, but I probably never want to play it 10 times in a row, like 10.
So you're saying you're not a pinball wizard?
I really like it, but I'm a dabbler.
Yeah, you know? I mean, you typically just go in there and say, okay, what was my last high score? All right, let's see if I can beat that. And that's it. You're done.
Yeah. But it's not something you want to have to go fish out of your game case, you know, and stick it in there at the expense of some other big RPG that you're playing through. And, you know, so it's just really great to have it there. And it's always on my home screen. It's like right next to whatever game card is in the system. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, usually I turn the system on and I'm like, okay, I've got 5 minutes, I'm going to play pinball, or I've got 15 minutes, I'm going to play, you know, Kid Icarus or Tales from the Abyss or whatever.
Right. It's exactly the same here. Always like a permanent position on my home screen, and it's always ready to go. So yeah, there's not that much to say about it. I think that you and I talked about the game already. But I have been also doing other things. I've gone to a gamer bar.
What?
Gamer. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Exactly.
Is this where you go to pick up gamers?
Yes, exactly. No, but like it's this place in Montreal called Funzo, which is a really weird name. I'm not sure what it comes from. But yeah, like the guy who started the bar is a big StarCraft fan and a big Street Fighter fan. So a lot of the space is basically like for StarCraft players and Street Fighter players with, you know, arcade joysticks and everything. There's a couple of pinball machines. Not very good. The Shaquille O'Neal one.
you mean very good Shaquille O'Neal,
yeah.
Correct?
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. Some old school arcade games, but my girlfriend and I just immediately gravitated towards the N64. And I played some Smash Brothers for the first time, like the N64 one.
Really? The first time?
Yeah.
Because you kind of skipped the whole N64 generation, didn't you?
Yeah, kind of. Like, beyond GoldenEye, like, basically, you know, my friends never really got the console either. And, like, we had been renting the thing for a while. Yes, people rented consoles.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember those days.
Yeah, we basically stopped after that. Like, GoldenEye was basically where it ended. I didn't really play Diddy Kong Racing or any of the other big multiplayer games that people really rave about all the time. But yeah, Smash Brothers, like, it was strange, you know? Like, it certainly holds up better on a big LCD screen than Mario Kart, because it's all polygons. And Mario Kart just looked so blurry and so, like, you couldn't see really very far ahead.
Well, I got a secret for you. Mario Kart 64 looked pretty shitty when it came out.
That's not really a secret.
It's only gotten worse since then. Mm. It was never a graphical showcase.
Yeah. But yeah, like, the N64 version is kind of strange because it looks like you can't really, like, charge your smashes. Or did I just, like, do it wrong?
That's right. No, you couldn't charge your smashes until Melee.
You get and smash.
And so few characters. What the hell?
Mm-hmm. Aren't there like 8 characters or something? It's
yeah,
really
one of them is
many.
Jigglypuff.
Hey, Jigglypuff is actually kind of overpowered, to be honest.
Actually, Kirby is really overpowered in that game.
I guess when you know what you're doing, maybe she or it is overpowered, but when you don't, you just fall asleep over a pit.
Yeah,
like, it's
the Jigglypuff down B where it goes, is actually like a really good projectile. But
that game was interesting though, because when it came out, it kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, they announced it in like Nintendo Power.
Yeah, and it was really kind of mind blowing when I first played it. I was like, wow, this is so different than anything else Nintendo has put out in a long time. It's really really.
It
cool.
was super weird, and you know,
very weird. Exactly.
I didn't like it very much at first because of the cadence of the way the characters move and jump. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty, I mean, it's kind of a common theme for Sakurai's games whenever he has characters in them, is that they often don't move the way you expect them to. Mm-hmm. But I think ultimately I became convinced that the amount of gravity that all the characters had and the way that they could all double jump, even though it didn't really fit the characters and stuff like that, it was all in service of the gameplay. Mm-hmm. And I never got into Smash Brothers until Melee, just because I never really had anyone to play it with until then. Melee came out when I was in the dorms.
Yeah.
So shit got real, okay? But
yeah, but I mean, it was also so much better than the original one as well. Like, so
it,
much.
It, like, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I think it's vastly better. But the original is, you know, it's on Virtual Console too, if anybody ever wants to check it out. But if you're just going to play it by yourself, don't bother, obviously.
Yeah.
Just don't. It's, because that's the first time I played Smash Brothers on N64, I just rented it and played it by myself. And I was like, what the hell? I mean, there's not much to do at all.
I actually bought it by myself and beat it in like, I don't know, 20 minutes. And then I'm like, well, that kind of sucks. And then I realized, oh, wait, I can unlock things. And then I unlocked all 4 characters. I'm like, okay, now what?
But yeah, the Funzo, pretty cool. Like, there were people playing a role-playing game in the corner.
You mean like tabletop, right?
You
like
know, Dungeons and Dragons
yeah.
kind of stuff.
Yeah,
they were arguing about, like, the nature of werewolves. It was incredibly nerdy. And, you know, like...
That's what happens.
Yeah, yep. And you can just, you know, there's, like, couches and tables, and you can just, like, play board games or Jenga or whatever it is you want. It's pretty cool. I like those bars. Like, I hate regular bars because there's really nothing to do except trying to talk over music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, over really loud music.
Yeah, but like in this setup, like there was music, but like it's really like a space where you can just relax, have a beer, play some games. It's pretty awesome. And you don't have to be afraid to bring like girls over there. Like it's very like nice and, yeah, I really liked it.
Do they have organized events?
They seem to, but again, like, it seems to center around, like, fighting games and StarCraft. So, but I think they have, like, a Monster Hunter night. Like, you know, like, probably when the game comes out for 3DS, like, there's going to be a ton of people with 3DSs playing that game over there.
It sounds like a good place for you to go Street Pass.
Well, not for now, actually. Like, it's weird. Like, I got a couple Street Passes the 2 or 3 times that I went there. But right now, like, it really seems like the people who go there are really, really into fighting games.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
And do they have poutine?
These are critical pieces of information we need, Guillaume. Just FYI.
They might. I don't really...
I'm trying to decide if it's worth a trip for me.
That's right. You know, there's a mental checklist that we make for every place in Montreal.
Over here, like, poutine is so plentiful, you really don't need to check, like, which place has it.
The streets are paved with poutine.
That's actually not good for your tires.
When you get off the plane, they just hand you poutine. There you go. Welcome to our country. gravy, cheese curd, enjoy.
Alright, so Guillaume, have you played anything else lately?
I sure have. Actually, as we perhaps all know, since the Sony conference made such a big deal about it at E3.
You bought a Wonder Book.
Wonder... James beat me to it.
I have PSN Plus, so I have, like, my instant PS3 collection. And so, like, I downloaded, like, 12 games or something ridiculous like that. But the one that I was most looking forward to playing was Infamous 2. Because I really liked the first one. I really liked the fact that, you know, it's mostly about platforming. Unlike something like GTA, which is about driving and shooting.
There's a lot of shooting also in Infamous. I mean, you're shooting electricity, but still, there's a lot of shooting.
Sure. But the platforming is pretty strong. And you know, like, shooters are not really my thing, but I vastly prefer third-person shooters over first-person ones. And, like, this fits the bill pretty well, you know. I really like the first game. Like, it's the first one that I got a platinum trophy for.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Right after that, I thought, like, well, I'm not ever going to do that again, because it was more of an ordeal than anything else, but...
Well, you would have to play the entire game at least twice.
Yep. Yeah, and that's exactly what I did. And like, there's something really addictive about that type of, you know, open world, like, go do missions type of game.
Yeah. Well, especially the way Infamous plays is, you know, it's, you can scale pretty much anything and, you know, shoot, like, kill guys from far away, and you can do the zip line kind of stuff and all that.
Yeah, so you get around the city pretty fast and you go from mission to mission, open up new stuff, and, yeah, like, it's hard to stop.
I can't remember. Do you have an Xbox?
I don't.
Okay. I was going to say, it sounds an awful lot like Crackdown.
It's quite a bit like Crackdown. Yeah, I'd say it's probably, you have more ways to definitely get around than in Crackdown. But It's the same kind of addictive sort of...
Your ways to get around in Crackdown are, get out of your car!
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, it's also, like, similar to a Spider-Man game. Because your character, you can basically kind of climb, not literally climb up walls... But there's enough nooks and crannies all over the place that you can pretty much just, you know, scale right up buildings and stuff.
Anyway, Infamous 2, it's really more of the same. They haven't really fixed anything that could be really annoying in the first game. They haven't changed the formula significantly. All they did was like, okay, now it's a new city, and you get some new powers, and go.
Isn't there some sort of, like, construction set or some sort of user-generated content?
Yeah, there is, but it must have been imposed by Sony with their whole, like, play and, like, what was it? Create, play, and share?
Yep.
It must have been, because, like, it's definitely not the tools that they use to create the actual missions in the game. Mm-hmm. I haven't tried it, but I have played some of the user-generated missions that were created actually by Sucker Punch. So, like, they used those really simplified tools to create, like, a bunch of missions, perhaps, like, to show people, like, what they can do with it. And it's really not very good. It's really, like, you get no voice acting, obviously, but you also, like, always have to press a button to make the dialogue, you know, keep on. And, stuff will appear out of nowhere. You know, like, you press a button and then, like, it tells you, like, and suddenly enemies appear and, like, enemies surround you all of a sudden without any kind of intro, without them, like, actually walking in on you. They just it's very basic and very.
Yeah. Yeah. I, when I heard that they had that feature in there, I didn't really know how they would implement it well. It just seemed like a strange kind of game to have that kind of feature in there. It just seemed kind of
like you can basically, like, rate the missions that you play and everything. All of the missions that I've, the user content that I played was actually by Sucker Punch, so I don't know what I have to do to actually play something by someone else. But maybe no one bothered. You know, who could blame them?
So when this game came out, I remember them talking about it on Giant Bombcast. Basically, the reviewer turned off the user generated levels because
oh, you can do that. Well, I know what I'm doing later, yeah.
I remember him basically saying, like, they're all like, you walk into an alley, and now there's 800 enemies around you.
Exactly.
And then you punch them all in the face, and then it's the end of the level.
But yeah, like, the sequel in a way, like, it's more of the same. It's, like, I don't really mind, but there's a reason why I didn't get the game immediately when it came out, and it, like, it's because, like, after playing through the first game twice, you really need to, like, it takes time to recharge, basically, like, to want to play the game again.
It's funny that you talk about GTA kind of with this, but that's how I feel after I play, you know, a GTA title. I'm just like, I don't need to go back to this for a couple of years. I'm pretty much done with it.
Or as we established in GTA 4, I don't need to go back to this
ever
the game.
Ever again. Yeah.
I mean, I usually don't even finish GTA games because I just get sick of them way before they, like, the mission structure is going way too long. And
yeah.
You know, the missions don't really change that much over the game.
Well, that was the one that just depressed the fuck out of all of us. We were like, this game.
Yeah.
But, one of the things that they touted in Infamous 2 was the fact that you could basically have either, like, fire or ice powers in addition to the electric ones. But it's really just, you know, BS. Like, it's just, like, ice variations of your current powers.
You shoot frozen electricity.
Well, no, not exactly. But, like, you've got, like, grenades in the game, basically electricity grenades. Well, now you've got ice grenades. You can shoot missiles. Well, now it's ice missiles. And I haven't tried the fire path, but I'm expecting it to be exactly the same.
That sounds like an old Sierra arcade RPG.
Well, I don't know. Like, I thought more like, oh, okay, we're going to go through all the elements. Now I'm going to throw Earth, and, like, the cycle would be complete.
Yeah. Yep.
You've turned into Avatar the Last Airbender.
Basically. Well, he's already kind of bald, so I could see, like, a skin made for that. Mm-hmm. Now I'm wondering if some of the user missions are actually Avatar the Last Airbender themed.
That would be pretty cool.
Yeah. But yeah, like, there's one power so far that I've seen that actually kind of changes the game. Not significantly, but, like, at least, you know, to some extent more than the ice powers have so far. And it's the ice launch power that just launches you into the air. So, if you're feeling lazy, you don't really want to climb an old building, like, that kind of changes how you get around a little bit.
Yeah, I always, like, in the first game, I really love the power that lets you boost when you're grinding on a rail. Mm-hmm. Or not on a rail, but, like, on a power line. Because it lets you kind of launch off the end of it and get a lot of speed. And then you combine that with the power that you get where you kind of hold your hands out and hover like that. What was that Jerry O'Connell show in the early 90s where he was like...
My Secret Identity.
He was a kid who got superpowers. He could float, but he couldn't fly. So he could sort of levitate off the ground and make himself weightless. And so the way he got around is he carried around these aerosol cans. And he would spray them to push himself forward. It was awesome.
Wow.
Weird association. Yeah.
I think the biggest problem I have with the game is one that they haven't fixed, and it would have been nice. And it's the whole morality system, which is just pure bullshit.
They didn't change it at all?
No, it's the same kind of deal where you have, like, okay, you've got this box of puppies. Do you pet them or do you rape them with a broken beer bottle, you know?
Whoa! Not my kind of game!
He's right. The moral choices in the first one were so laughable, and everybody hated it, and I can't believe they didn't try to fix it.
Like, you have to commit several mass murders to be deemed, like, evil enough to get the best evil powers. Like, you have to be consistently an asshole. You have to always, like, choose the bad choice in the missions. But you have, like, to basically kill absolutely everything in your path. You have to be the worst psychopath that the Earth has ever seen.
Your Honor, in my defense, I really wanted that power-up.
Come here, play this game. It's the morality system, man. It's not me.
And to be good, you have to heal everyone, you have to save everyone, you have to always pick the right path.
You have to recycle.
It's not even, there's no ambiguity at all. Like, it's always very clear if it's right or wrong. And most of
it gets to the point where you wish there was just a menu option when you started the game that said, do you want to be good or evil? And you just pick one, and then it automatically sets all those choices throughout the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, people said that about Mass Effect, but I do think over the course of that franchise, they've gotten better at making you actually consider the options a little bit more. So, like, in Mass Effect 3, I played all three of those games as Paragon, which is, like, good guy. But there's a moment in that game where you have an opportunity to, let's say, to apprehend someone who's turned out to be a bad person. And the Paragon choice is clearly to, like, arrest them or negotiate with them or, you know, try to let them kill themselves as they run away from you or something like that. But you get one of these, renegade action moments where it just pops up on the screen and this person's like really threatening you and is clearly a bad seed, you know, and is like doing some really, really heinous shit. And I'm a Paragon and everything up to that point, pretty much across the entire franchise, I've always done like the good guy thing. But there comes this moment where I've got my gun pointed at him and I'm trying to talk him down and trying to be like, look, you got to stop this. And he, you know, he's really not going to do it. And the little red thing comes up for the renegade action. And I knew if I pulled it, I'm going to shoot this guy. Mm-hmm. And I said, bye, motherfucker. I blew his brains out because he was a total asshole.
Right.
And he deserved it. So
were you penalized for that or what?
Not really. I mean, I might have lost an achievement. I'm not totally sure on that. But at this point, I don't really care about achievements that much.
Even in the early games, and I'm going to spoil Mass Effect 1. Deal with
Go
it.
Go ahead.
There's a scene where you come across the queen of this race of giant bugs.
Yeah, yeah.
And basically that's the last one left. And it's not really clear what the most moral choice is because this thing's pleading for its life essentially. But mm-hmm. everyone else around you is telling you, no, they're like a scourge. They will kill everything.
Yeah, they almost destroyed the galaxy the last time that they populated.
Like, okay, so do I really let this one go and believe what she says, or do I kill the fuck out of it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure if it really, like, applies to Infamous at all, because, like, the choices are so clear-cut. Like, I think the major problem with letting you to pick, like, a light or a dark side in this game is that it really flies in the face of, like, the narrative. Because, okay, I've been, like, super good the whole time. I've been careful. I've been healing everyone. I've always chosen the right path. And, you know, like, 15 hours into the game, I'm still getting choices. Like, you know, like this demon on my left shoulder who's like, oh, okay, let's kill everyone. And, like, the angel on the other shoulder, like, no, let's just, you know, pet some puppies. And I
like puppies.
Well, who doesn't? Evil Cole is who. But, yeah, like like at this point in the game, do you really think that I'm going to choose to kill everyone? You know, like the guy in the cutscene is still acting like he's considering it. No, like my options are open.
It's almost like the developer is baiting you to accidentally hit the wrong button. And then you're going to be like, no, I just lost my trophy. Ah.
Yeah, but there's not really any chance of that because, like, basically the way you do your choices is that you're going to have, like, the choice between, like, a red mission and a blue mission. I'm going to let you guess which is good and which is bad. And, like, they're not even, like, at the same spot on the map. So there's absolutely no risk of accidentally picking one. So really, like, it's just like, it's so stupid to look at Cole being like, no, wait, like, let's listen to the person who's telling me to nuke the whole city because that could be a good idea.
You know, this guy might have some ideas.
But now the thing is, if you change up what you're doing halfway through, do you just totally screw yourself?
You might. I haven't tried really, but I think you might lock yourself out of some powers that you've already unlocked.
Yeah, that's pretty silly.
The system really, like, it's so slow to build up, you know, one side or the other that I don't think that you could unlock, like, both sides on the same playthrough, so it's really pointless.
Yeah, that's how it's balanced out.
Yeah.
Okie doke. Well, why don't we move on to what John's been playing?
All right, well, speaking of more of the same...
Oh, no.
I did manage to pick up, I saw, you know, Black Ops for 360 cheap, and, you know, since I'm the first-person shooter guy, I got to pick it up, play through it. So I played through the campaign. It's really nothing to write home about. There's a bad guy. You kill him at the end.
What?
But the thing is, what really surprised me about it is for a game that sold so many copies and has been so popular, and a game that's actually been out for, I mean, it was released in 2010 now. Yeah. And it patched when it applied a patch when I started it up. It's just how buggy it is. It really amazed me.
Lead platform. I mean,
yeah. It was really surprising. There was actually, I played through the whole campaign. So there was the one level, it's like set in the Arctic, but you go through to the very end and you walk into this room and what's supposed to happen is all the doors are supposed to close And then, you know, a bunch of guys rush in and you have to like break the windows and get out. And then there's a huge, you know, gun battle. But, you know, the first time I came up to it, I walked into the room and it has, and the way they space out the checkpoints is they have a little dot with, you know, how far you are away from it. So how far you have to go to the next checkpoint. And so I roll up to the checkpoint, I walk into the room and nothing happens. The cutscene just did not trigger at all. And I was like, okay, that's pretty lame. So I had to restart. And the thing is, when you restart, you don't just restart at the last checkpoint. You restart all the way at the beginning of the area. So that, really? You know, oh yeah. So that dropped about, you know, it took me at that point, it probably took me about half an hour, 45 minutes to get to that point. So I had to go all the way back to the beginning. So I was like, wow, that's pretty lame.
And the same thing actually happened to me in the first COD, Modern Warfare, really? I mean. Yeah, on the PlayStation 3. Yeah. In one mission, like there was like this hostage inside a house and the door never opened. I had a like rocket launcher, but no.
Yeah.
It's a very big risk with these heavily scripted games.
You're scripting better script.
When you script out all these events, you better make sure they actually activate at the right time or else the whole game is screwed.
Well, what amazed me was the fact that this game is so scripted. I mean, you're effectively walking through a tunnel really for most of the game. I mean, there's open areas, but...
What's weird about that is that while Call of Duty Modern Warfare had gone that way, the Black Ops team had sort of stayed closer to the roots of the series until this game. At which point they said, we're going to do that too then. I actually prefer the non-scripted event version of Call of Duty franchise.
The problem that I had with, you know, design-wise, I figured out as I played through it that really you were just bouncing from checkpoint to checkpoint and it would just keep throwing guys at you regardless. Just as long, I mean, you could literally...
There are infinite enemies!
It was ridiculous because I figured out, hey, wait a minute. If I just make it to that next checkpoint, then all the guys will just disappear and I can just move on. So I wound up just running through rooms. Sit there. I wouldn't even try to kill anybody. I would just try to run through the room without getting killed to make it to the next checkpoint. Because once you make it to the next checkpoint, you're fine. You're golden.
Yeah.
So it was really, really lame. It was just a bunch of kill rooms. And well, that's just such a, it's such a throwback design for a first-person shooter. You know, it takes me back to like the N64 when I'm playing with friggin' James Bond at the very end. And, you know, like all the guys are rushing in. You're trying to like, you know, go after Jaws or something. It's just GoldenEye. It kept reminding me over and over again of GoldenEye.
I'm thinking of that room in Nightfire where the alarm keeps going off and the same five guards keep coming in over and over.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of that in this game and it really surprised me. And then the other bug I ran into, the other huge bug, this one to me was, this is probably like really the most shocking bug I've actually come across. And this is including, you know, bugs where a game, where it won't save your game or something like that. Like, you know, those kind of Skyrim sort of bugs. But with this one...
Put your dragonflies backwards?
Yeah, like all that kind of just goofy kind of stuff. But with this one, after being in that Arctic area, you know, I went on a bit further. And again, I was probably about 75% through. I've been probably playing for about a half an hour or so. It's quite deep into this one area. And all of a sudden, screen just goes black, and I get an error. And this wasn't like... It was a debug error stating something to the effect of... There was a character model that was invalid because it had more than 160 bones. Now, every character model in a game, for those that don't know, is actually made up of bones, and then they put the polygon mesh on it. So this was literally an invalid.
Bones.
Yeah, from the research that I did, and you can look it up. It's a very well-known bug. It's, you know, just look up 160 bones Call of Duty Black Ops, and you'll find it. Apparently, what it is when you blow up a character, something happens, like his hand flies off or something, because the actual object that it lists is something like Russian Spetsnaz L arm off. So it's something like when you blow somebody's arm off, but something happens when that is spawned that produces a character model that the game engine chokes on. And I couldn't believe it. And the thing is, so it gives you this debug message, and then it says, click A to proceed. You press A, and it takes you back to the main menu.
Does it actually say click A?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a console level. Like, it's something that I would expect to see if I was playing, like, if I was playing the game at E3, if I was playing, like an alpha.
How has this not been fixed?
They just never fixed it. I have no idea. I mean, and the thing is, the game patched when I started it up, so they just haven't fixed it. They never bothered fixing
it. That's astounding.
Well, yeah, if you stopped having so many bones, Lindemann, you wouldn't be able
to. Yeah,
no,
I know. 160 bones.
But, like,
you
have to consider, like, if they spend too much time just debugging the thing, like, they're not going to be profitable. because it's such a small series.
But yeah, the profit margin's so thin, they have to keep it in order.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's other like little glitchy bugs too that you kind of see, and like that's why it's like I always look at Treyarch or Treyarch, however you want to say it. Like I look at it less, at them as kind of like the B team for that series, because you know there's like glitchy little stuff, like you know you'll blow something up and there'll be like a chair that will get stuck in midair, or you'll shoot a guy and his gun will fly up and it'll stay in midair. Just glitchy kind of stuff like that. That
wow.
Yeah, it's just really, really buggy.
You know, they probably aren't allowed to spend, like, to push back, certainly, like, the mm-hmm. release of the game when they debug the thing. So
yeah.
I don't know. And, like, probably as soon as they're done with one game, they're starting on the next, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're
yeah,
starting on the DLC. Or they've got two separate teams, probably. One starts working on the DLC for all the Elite members, and the other starts working on the next game.
Yeah, I mean, but I will say that I've played a lot of Modern Warfare 3, and there's no issues like this in Modern Warfare 3. There's no glitches. You don't have any weird stuff happening. It just doesn't happen.
So I'll go next with new business, and I wanted to be playing Tomba this week. It just was released on PlayStation Network a few days ago, and it's a game that I've wanted to play since it originally came out for PS1 back in the mid-90s. And the reason I wanted to play it, the reason I wanted to talk about it on the show, is because it's a very rare example of basically a 2D platformer for PS1. I guess it's kind of like 2.5D. I think there's a little bit of depth that you can go back and forth in. But for the most part, it's kind of like Klonoa or Pandemonium, you know. Kirby 64, I guess, is also probably a good comparison. It had really nice graphics at the time. It was original character, and it's a platform. There just weren't that many good platformers on PlayStation. Really, in the whole generation, N64 really dominated with platformers, but they were all 3D platformers. So very few good 2D platformers, except for Kirby and Yoshi.
But is this game good for the time? Or like was it only acceptable because there was nothing else? Or
well,
is it
I don't know, because it certainly got very good reviews at the time, and right. That's part of the reason I wanted to play it all the way back then. But now it's become very rare and very expensive. And so, you know, not that many people really have ever played it. It's kind of one of these legendary, sort of hidden gem games. Well, you've played it. What do you think, James?
I played it in like 97, but yeah, I mean it's pretty good. I mean I enjoyed playing it. I mean yeah. It's kind of fanciful. It feels a bit like a mascot platformer,
mm-hmm.
which Sony already had their mascot platformer, and so it didn't really get the mascot platformer treatment. But in the end, I always actually really enjoyed it. I felt like it was It was a good mix of actioniness, because you had to fight all the enemies that were in the stage by jumping on them, and I don't know what you want to call it that he does to them.
Yeah, you like throw them or something.
He like violates them and then he throws them. I mean,
he is a caveman.
Yeah.
Right?
So I believe the enemies are pigs, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
And basically jumps on their back and then like makes a noise and then heaves them, and it's actually kind of a nice mix of action and platforming. So for me, it had good pace to it. It was an enjoyable experience to get through.
Well, I look forward to playing it at some point, because I downloaded it. It's $10 on PSN, which is a little expensive for a PS1 game, but considering this game was going for like $100 on disc, you know, used, I was like, fine. I don't care. It's $10.
Yeah.
But I downloaded it. I tried to install it. It said that it installed, but then when I got back to the cross media bar, it was still in its little bubble, looking like I needed to install it again. So I tried installing it 2 or 3 times. Nothing, I mean, I didn't get any errors or anything, but nothing actually ever happened. I was like, what the, I've never seen this before. So I deleted it, went back to the store, re-downloaded it. Same thing happened.
Okay, but did you check like lower, like below the bubble? Like, did you look at your installed games to see if it was there? Because
I did not. No, I didn't think about
recently,
that.
Recently, since one of the updates, I think that in order to allow people to download those PS1 or PS Mini games and to install them both to like the PS3 and then copy the thing to their PSP or Vita, like they allow you to keep the bubble thing.
Really?
So you copy that bubble thing to the PSP and you install it there instead of basically downloading it twice.
Oh, weird.
So, yeah, it might have been that. I don't know.
Well, it's been a while since I downloaded a PS1 game. So maybe that's the case. I'll have to check that out. I didn't look because I think it does tend to – I think it's organized so that it does throw PS1 games down at the bottom, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't go down there to look for it. I just assumed that since the bubble was still there, it didn't actually install. I'll have to check that out, man. Thanks for the idea. So maybe next week you'll hear me talk about Tomba. I would love to. It seems like a cool game.
Take that, PS. Oh, sorry, PSN.
It's still their fault. I mean, the cross media bar is still kind of shitty. So.
It's a bad interface.
There's that.
If you install something and you don't know that it actually installed, that's not really my fault. That's a bad interface.
It is. It's a crappy interface for sure.
Well, if that's what actually happened, I'll be very happy because as it is, I'm working with Sony customer support and they're telling me that, you know.
How have they not suggested this?
Well, yeah. I mean, they told me to I had to boot my PS3 into safe mode, which I didn't even know that it had one.
You have to hold down the button, right?
Yeah, you have to hold the power button down wait for this weird sequence of beeps.
Yep.
So I booted up in safe mode, and then I got this system like BIOS menu and told it to restore the file system. And then I got this message when it rebooted saying that my hard disk was corrupted and now it's going to repair. And I'm like, oh, great. Now I'm going to lose all my save files.
Yeah.
And it went through this process, and then it booted back to the cross media bar, and all my stuff was still there. So it didn't actually wipe the hard disk. It just told me that it was going to. So, but
oh no, it's eternal darkness is what it is.
Yeah. So just
I love this gen of gaming.
Yeah, it's just a total mess. It's a total mess. I mean, look.
And John, you complain about having to clean out the fridge.
No one ever accused Sony of making good operating systems. So yes. But what I have been playing, thankfully, on my portable 3DS is Kid Icarus Uprising, and I don't think I've actually really talked about this game on the show. I know Greg talked about it when he first got it. I haven't been playing the multiplayer. In fact, the only time I played multiplayer was against Guillaume back at PAX East, and that was local. And I just remember being very confused about what was going on, and I did very poorly. So I really can't speak to it. I'm just not really all that interested in playing this particular game online, but, you know, it sounds like it's a really well done for the people who are into it. But, you know, I've been trying to blast through the campaign, and, man, it is a much longer campaign than you would expect for this kind of game. I'm on chapter 15 now, and I really don't have – I mean, the story is so nonsensical that it's hard to tell actually how far I am into the story. Which I guess you could say is a good thing, you know, you don't really see the whole arc ahead of you, but I just don't know, am I really even getting close to the end? I don't know. I mean, it just feels like I've been playing the game for a long time, and some of the missions take like an hour to go through, which is really not that great for portable gaming. I mean, I will play, you know, they'll have like a couple of checkpoints. They're not really checkpoints, but they're like places where it'll load the next section and it says midpoint progress. And usually right after I get through one of those, I'll close the system and come back to it later. Cause I rarely play 3DS for like an hour at a time. But some of these stages are really long. And then sometimes you can go in there and spend 15 minutes just in the menus because you've got all these weapons that you're getting and you've got hearts and you've got a lot of different things you can do with your hearts. And you've got this achievement system and the eggs and all this crap that you can do in between missions that can actually take up quite a bit of time. And the weapon system, I feel like I'm slowly coming to grips with how it works and how do you identify a good weapon and how do you fuse weapons into new ones to actually make them better. But the game really doesn't explain that stuff very well. So it's kind of like you do a little trial and error. You'll probably accidentally lose a weapon that you really liked. I really, you know, but for a game that is supposedly all about the loot and it's got hundreds and thousands of weapons and all these different like attributes they get and everything. You can combine them and sell them and trade them and, you know, street pass them and all this stuff. The fact that you can only equip one weapon per mission and the missions are sometimes an hour long is really out of sync with all the infrastructure that they've built into this. I mean, I should be able to have like a loadout of three different weapons that I can switch among. Item, you know, just with the D-pad or something very, very quickly. And that way I can have one for close range stuff, one for long range stuff, etc.
Gears of Icarus, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still choosing them. It's not like I'm picking them up off of enemies or something. But the idea of a loot game where you can only change your equipment every hour is really absurd. And that's, you know, sometimes that's what Kid Icarus is.
I don't know. Like, I think it's part of the strategy. Like, sometimes you would want a club that's really, really good when you're underground, but you have to remember, oh shit, like, there's, like, the flying mission before. So you want to pick something that's also good for that. Then, like, it's kind of like this balance that they want to... You have to pick your weapon.
Because every campaign level has both the flying shooty levels that are like Star Fox and the ground levels, which are more like a third-person shooter that have more up-close stuff. It basically forces you to pick a weapon that's kind of balanced between those two extremes. So there are entire classes of weapons that are like purely for up close combat or purely for really long range combat that aren't really practical for the campaign because you do need something that does both. So again, it's just like, it feels like the campaign and the weapon system were developed by two different teams.
But sometimes, like, you might have like a particularly hard mission underground that you want a specific weapon for, but then, like, you have to make sure that you can actually get through the flying section with it. Like, well, it's really, like, you have to, like, oh, okay, I'm going to try to do really, really well, be really careful during the flying segment, and then you can use your super awesome weapon on the ground.
That makes sense if you're playing through the level for a second or third time.
Yes.
But considering the campaign has already taken me well over 10 or 12 hours, and I don't even know if I'm close to the end yet, I just don't see myself going back and spending a whole lot of time replaying missions. I know that, you know, with the difficulty system, they give you some reasons to do that, but I don't really want to either. I mean, for me, the joy of the game, and there is a lot of joy in it, even though I don't absolutely love Kid Icarus, but I like it. And the best parts are just seeing the bizarre imaginative stuff that they throw at you every level. Every level looks so different and is so creative. And the design of them is just really interesting, even though the gameplay is quite often lacking or just frustrating, that I'm always excited to go see the next thing. But for the same reason, I don't really want to go back and see that other thing again, because the part that I liked the best about it was the surprise. And once Right. that's worn off, the level itself is not that great to play through. You know, I really don't want to go back and do all that crappy platforming with auto jump and, you know, your character's dashing when you don't want him to and your hands cramping up after 15 minutes. I mean, I just there's not enough incentive for me to do that. Sorry. I just want to play through the campaign once. And
I had a better time with the campaign personally. Like I did replay missions, especially the early ones, a lot, you know, like you said, third or fourth time, but like, you know, I played maybe like the first mission 15 times, but it's true that you're way past the initial discovery, but at that point, you're really trying to master every encounter and try to make it through the level still alive on like the level 9, intensity. So, there's a lot of fun to be had there if that's what you're into.
Sure. I mean, the idea is there, you're almost like memorizing the layout, right? Like, you know where the enemies are going to pop out and
take them out as efficiently as you can and try to survive.
That's fine. You know, if the missions were 5 minutes long, I might be interested in doing that. But when they're 15, 20 minutes long, it just doesn't work for me. You know, it's not like a shoot 'em up where, you know, like I've got Radiant Silver Gun on XBLA and I can play through an entire sitting of that game through like multiple levels in 5 minutes. And if I die at the end, well, I've made some progress. I've gotten some experience for my weapons. I start over. I'll sit there and play through it three or four times in one sitting. And, you know, every time I learn a little bit more and I build up my memory of where all this stuff is, and that's satisfying, but that's because that's a really fast paced game. And Kid Icarus is just not, you know, the levels are really big. And they're complicated and they have you do all this different stuff. I will say the levels are diverse in the sense that pretty much every level you have the flying part in the beginning. At some point you will find a vehicle. At some point you'll get on some grind rails, Sonic style, which again basically turns it into just a shooting gallery because you're not really controlling your movement at that point. And at some point they will make you do some really shitty platforming because Pit can't actually jump. But if there's a green arrow on the ground, you can dash that way and he'll jump over a pit. And once the platforms start moving around and you're getting shot at, it becomes really horrible. So they do their best to try to make these levels really dynamic. And I respect that a lot, but they're just, the game is so uneven. I mean, I think the flying parts of the stage, like the first 5 minutes of every stage is fantastic. And I would love to get a mode when I finish the campaign, I'd love to get a mode where I can just play all of those strung together. And it basically just turns into a Star Fox game. Give me that, please. Because the stuff on the ground is just not nearly, I mean, it's not horrible, but it's clearly not as good. It's just not nearly as good. And I just don't want to play through all that stuff over again, you know? So, you know, whatever.
Yeah, fair
it's,
enough.
It's really beautiful. I mean, the graphics are astounding. The music is quite good. The writing is legitimately funny. Yeah. And the voice acting is pretty good too, which, boy, thank God they, I guess they got our criticisms back a couple E3s ago when they showed that game. The voice acting was so just horrible.
It was just funny.
It was dreadful.
It was just
really
funny.
They really put a lot of money into the production and the presentation, and it pays off. I mean, it makes the game feel like a Saturday morning cartoon, and not very many video games feel that way anymore. So I give them a lot of credit for that. The game itself is, you know, a lot of it I don't find to be incredibly fun to play, but I'm willing to go through it because I like the other parts enough, you know? So I certainly don't regret purchasing it. It's been an interesting experience. It's probably not going to make my top five at the end of the year, but it's unique, that's for sure.
The only reason I stopped playing is that I lost my copy somewhere before E3.
Ooh. Yikes.
I know.
All right, James, why don't you wrap up new business?
I've been playing a bit more of Pandora's Tower. I've hacked my way through a few more towers. I planned on being done this week, but I'm not. So I will reserve further comments on this game until such time that I finish it. I will quickly state that I'm still enjoying it, although for me it is the weaker of the three of the quote games that we aren't getting, the rainfall games that we are now getting that we aren't getting. It's a very different experience, so I'll have a lot more to say about it when I'm done. What I have been playing, a review game, is a game called Seven Wonders of the World 2.
Sounds like a winner.
Shouldn't they have called it the Eight Wonders of the World?
So this is, or the Nine Wonders of the World, I don't know. This is a DSiWare game, but, alright, so I'm going to describe it for you because it's kind of a novel concept. Basically, you have this grid and these jewels fall down, and then you slide them around to try to make three in a row, and then they go away, and then the jewels fall down to fall into their place.
Oh, it's Puzzle Quest.
What? You mean this game has been made before? Oh. Well, there goes all the originality then. Yeah, that's all this game is. It's that, and then you play the same level like seven times so you can build these wonders of the world, and then you go on to the next wonder of the world. The only thing that changes is the levels become more intricate, which makes no real difference, and there's more music. That's basically it. And the music itself sounds like it's being played by a pinball machine circa 1984. For me, though, beyond commentary on this game, it's really incredibly mindlessly boring. I just want to point out one comment, because we'll have to say about it. So they ran through the original Seven Wonders of the World already, because it's the sequel, so what the fuck are we going to do now? So they did, like, Stonehenge, they did, I can't remember the other one I did, but they did the Angkor Wat, which they put in Myanmar, where it isn't. But they also spelled Myanmar wrong. So way to go, developers of Seven Wonders of the World. They spelled it Mayan Mars.
Oh, it's painful.
Good fucking job. So,
oh man,
that's all I have to say about Seven Wonders of the World.
Like, it's not even our world; it's a different world. What the heck?
Spell check the names of your levels.
That's horrible.
All I'm asking.
That's terrible. You know, I mean, the structure of the game sounds a little bit like the new Tetris for N64, because you were like building pyramids and stuff like that in that game, weren't you? And it's a puzzle game, you know, it's not Bejeweled, but it's, you know, it's Tetris. And that game actually, you know, basically the idea was that you had to clear a bunch of lines in order to build up these different monuments. And it was a really thin premise to keep you playing Tetris over and over again.
Right.
But the advantage was when you unlocked a new level, you got a new song. And in that game, it sounds like unlike the Seven Wonders of the World 2, but in the new Tetris, the music was amazing. And so you really wanted to unlock the new levels because you wanted to hear that awesome song.
Right. So what this game does is basically you have to, you have to wipe out a piece on every block on the grid. So the grids are colored in, and then when you destroy a block on it, it loses its coloration. So you have to clear a block on every space in the grid by the end of the level. And as you complete the level, this building block descends, and you have to clear all its way to the bottom. And that gives you, like, three spaces to fill in on the monument, and then you get to do it all over again until you build the giant ass monument. It's really not enjoyable in the slightest. So congratulations.
It kind of reminds me of Alpha Bounce with its endless missions. And,
yeah.
You know, like, all of them are so pointless and so, like, not... Like, there's no feature that's really interesting to them.
No, and to be honest, it kind of baffles me that someone thought that the DSi needed another Match 3 game. But it is what it
it's
is.
It's not that they thought it would need it, they thought people might buy one.
It is what it is. It will probably end up being the shortest review I've ever written, so congratulations to them for that, at least.
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up new business. When we come back, we've got your listener mail, so stick around. We'll be right back.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Have impressions of Rabbids Land on the Wii U by Aaron Kaluska. It's another theme park game on the Wii U, this time with the always charming Rabbids. We also have a review, Funky Barn on 3DS by Patrick Barnett. It's a farming simulator in 3D. It's about what you expect from a game called Funky Barn.
Alright, Alex Gulafi brings us a preview of Pokemon Black and White. Pokemon! It's Pokemon!
Wait, but Pokemon Black and White 2. Right.
Oh, yeah, but Black and White
2. Good job, James.
Sorry, John.
Slow clap for James Jones, everybody. Even though I probably should have picked that up myself, so kind of got to punch myself in the face for that one.
Okay, you do it on air.
Yeah. We also have a review of Cat Frenzy, a.k.a. Lindemann's House, on DSiWare by Patrick Barnett. It's a game about getting cats out of a well in Match 3 format, much like a weekend at my place.
Next up, we've got a review for Penguin Patrol on DSiWare by James Dawson. He says you can slide penguins on ice in an average puzzle game. And we've got an interview, my interview, along with TYP, and we interviewed Jaron Moore from the Zelda Symphony of the Goddesses tour. You heard it on last week's podcast. If you happen to skip through it or if you just want to go back in and review it, we have a transcription of it on the website now. You can read it all in text format, and I loved talking to Jaron. He's a really, really fun, enthusiastic guy, and he put on a great concert. So there's some links in that article as well if you're interested in seeing whether the tour is going to come through your area, and there's also a link to Club Nintendo where you can get discounted tickets.
We have a review with more Pokemon in Pokemon Conquest by Josh Max. You're a Poke Warlord. It's a word I made up for combining Pokemon and Warlord. It's kind of like combining me and Universe. This Tecmo Koei Nintendo collaboration is a lot better than that pun. Also, we have video, more of our E3 exclusive video, this one trying to gameplay footage from E3, brought to you by Jaron Rosenberg and TYP, and we have even more exclusive videos in the same article of other games, including the Donkey Kong Kart game and other stuff.
If you have not yet seen Trying To in motion, you should watch this. You will not believe how beautiful it is. Good stuff. All right, so be sure to go over and check out all of this great original content along with the latest news from Nintendo Direct and everything else happening post E3, plus all the latest screenshots and videos. We got our forums up there. It's all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show. Over the break, I played 30 Seconds of Tomba. So, yes, John was right. It was on my system.
It's Guillaume, wasn't it? Guillaume was right.
Oh, Guillaume, excuse me.
Damn it! Don't mix up your Canadians.
So many to choose from.
Hey, Canadians, they all look the same to me.
All I had to do to find the game was scroll down about 20 icons on the cross-media bar. So, anyway, that's great. I will be playing that after the show. But for this segment, we're going to do listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And Guillaume has the first email this week.
Oh, I do. Chris writes, I've noticed when I browse retail shelves anymore, it's easier to find Remote Plus controllers than the original version. And I'm curious if, based on your E3 experiences, Nintendo is moving towards Motion Plus as the new standard. For the sake of better motion control in gaming, I would hope this would be the case, yet I can't imagine Rayman or New Super Mario Bros. U needing particularly advanced motion. What controllers aside from the gamepad did you see being used, and do you expect Nintendo and third parties to make better use of Motion Plus with the ushering in of a new console? I just want to say anecdotally that every time a representative talked about the remote, they said Wii Motion Plus. When I was present.
Yeah, so for the past 2 or 3 years, ever since Remote Plus came out,
yep,
that all the remotes in Nintendo's E3 booth have been Remote Pluses. They're going to use whatever the best thing is. Mm-hmm. It's just like the year DS Lite came out. All of a sudden, every DS in their booth were DS Lites.
Right.
And you had to go to a third-party booth to find an old DS.
Right.
And in this case, this year, the only booth really anywhere where they actually had Wii U games where you could have made this comparison was Ubisoft. And Ubisoft had Remote Pluses because the only game they used that I think actually supported Motion Plus or supported remotes was Sports Connection, which I'm pretty sure requires Motion Plus.
So yeah, so, I mean, it makes sense, though, because Nintendo basically uses new hardware for these events. They don't want to reuse stuff. But
I'm talking, like, specifically, they were, like, answering questions from journalists, and they were saying that, oh, you'll be able to use the Wii Motion Plus.
Wii Remote Plus.
Wii Remote Plus. And
right.
That's always what they refer to. But, of course, like, they could have just been trained to say that.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. They're very good about being on message. I mean...
Well, look, I don't think they actually manufacture normal remotes anymore.
Probably not.
So they're basically phasing them out. I mean, technically, the Wii U will, I'm sure, support original Wii remotes because you'll be able to play backwards-compatible Wii games on it.
Oh, yeah.
But for new games on Wii U, I expect a lot of them, if not all of them, as a standard, will require Motion Plus, just because that's the new standard.
Yeah.
So if you go buy a Wii remote at the store right now, it will be a Remote Plus. And if you actually need to go buy a controller, you would want that anyway, right? So, yes, there will be a few people who have old remotes, and they buy a Wii U, and they try to play five-player Mario, and they find that a couple of theirs aren't. But for Mario, you know, that's the kind of game where, just like Chris says in his email, you don't really need the Motion Plus in that game, as far as we know, and so they probably won't require it. But if they, you know, so I just don't think it's a big deal. I mean, I think the more interesting question is, might we see a resurgence in Motion Plus development now that there's a new console out and more third parties are making games for Wii U than they made for Wii? Because Motion Plus came out, you know, somewhat late in the cycle for Wii. In terms of third-party support, it was very late in the cycle, mm-hmm. even though it was only about halfway through the actual generation. So, you know, I think a lot of developers are going to be making Wii games for the first time, and if they're going to use remotes, they might as well support Motion Plus, because, especially by now, most people should have it.
Yeah, I mean, if I think about it, I only own 2 Wii games that are third party and are Motion Plus beyond just, like, quote, enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at the bare minimum, they have to support it more. I mean, just because they physically could not support it less. So.
Good point.
Like, the one thing that would worry me, but not really, but I mean, like, the developers don't really have experience developing for Wii Motion Plus, so are we going to see, like, lots of failed attempts, like experiments and, you know, people trying things that don't really work with the tech?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, but we'll see that with the Wii U tablet controller, too.
Not that much, really. I think at this point, though, the technology's been around long enough that most developers should have a pretty good idea of what it's actually capable of versus the myth of, you know, what we originally thought. And
Wii Motion Plus will be Star Wars.
I don't think so. I mean, the other thing is, a lot of devices have gyroscopes in them. Motion Plus was kind of the first consumer-level MEMS gyroscope control device, and it was novel at the time, but not for very long, because soon after that, Apple added it to the iPhone, mm-hmm. and then it was in the iPad, and now it's in the Wii U gamepad tablet, and it's also in the Vita, and it's also in the 3DS. And, you know, it's just like, it's not that unusual of a technology anymore. So I think there's tons of APIs and, you know, documents and literature or whatever. If you want to support that feature, it's not that hard to do. It's not like you have to pave new ground in order to do it.
I'm thinking more like on a game design standpoint, because like, yeah, there might be a gyroscope in your 3DS or your iPhone, but you're not going to be using those in the same way that you would use like the gyroscope in something that has the format of a remote.
It's in the gamepad too. So to an extent, they'll have experience with that. But I mean, I expect like all console launches, we're going to get this the early period where people don't quite get what they're doing. Mm. And we'll see games at the launch cycle that have tacked on gyro controls that don't work right. We'll see games from developers who never made Wii games, who are now trying to learn the whole thing in one shot and are probably going to struggle with it a bit. And we'll see developers who just don't engage it at all. I mean, Ubisoft should be okay with it because they own one of the only two Motion Plus third-party games I own. I mean, I think they made like three of them, so they might have the most experience of any third-party developer.
Yeah, probably.
I just don't see this being a big problem, because if you think about it, in order for a developer to really need to support Motion Plus and Wii Remotes, that would mean they're going to have to be making at least a three-player game, because they can probably figure that, especially these third-party developers, they're maybe making a multi-platform game and Wii U is just one of three or four different platforms they're supporting. They're probably going to expect you first and foremost to use the gamepad, which means that they'll be basically porting the controls over from another system, and they'll be concerned about the screen, but they're probably not going to have you waving the controller around in the air to do something. Yeah. And beyond that, they might expect you to use a pro controller, because it's that kind of game. And I think I expect the pro controller will be more widely supported and more widely available than the classic controller ever was. For one thing, it's a totally separate controller. So it just makes more sense, right?
No more dongle life.
And it kind of supports Nintendo's message of like wanting to really cater to these third parties and make a controller that's extremely easy for them to support. And I don't think, now a lot of people are asking, and like, you know, there was really no way to tell at E3, but I don't think that controller has motion control in it. I don't think it has vibration. It just weighs nothing. It's like a six axis. I mean, maybe it has, I think they probably just figure if you're using this, you probably don't care about motion control. You know, and if the third party developer supports that, then they don't have to worry about it either. So the only reason that they would have to really think about it, and they might be tempted to do something really creative or really terrible with Motion Plus, is if they're making a game that they expect people to actually primarily play with a Wii Remote. And I don't think that many third parties are going to be doing that. I mean, if anything, they might make, you know, like a four player or five player game where it's like a party game, they're trying to get a lot of people together. But if a lot of people are all playing together in the same room, you're probably not going to ask them to wave the controllers all over the place, because they'd smack each other in the face.
Oh, that was my favorite part of Wii.
Right, but you don't expect people to come out and try to make like the new Red Steel 2 that's like really heavily dependent on Motion Plus.
That answers kind of the his question, though. Like, for the sake of better motion control in gaming, he would hope for it to be the case that they would move towards Wii Remote Plus, but then we're not going to get the kind of the deeper experiences that actually put to use the Wii Motion Plus.
I actually won't be surprised if there are games that come out that do make real, meaningful use of the Wii Motion Plus in the future.
They'll be made by Nintendo.
Well, that's
probably
fine.
Yeah, I would agree.
But they're still developers. I mean, I can see people making real, solid games like that.
I mean, the new Tiger Woods will support it, I'm sure, but they already know how to use it on Wii, so it's just not a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like the whole R&D with that type of gameplay has kind of been done, and people are sort of like, okay, you can use it for this, but not that.
I mean, how many Move games are coming out?
Not many.
Because that's PlayStation Move is basically Wii Remote Plus. It's a little better, actually. It's got magnetometers and stuff, but it's nobody cares. Nobody's making that stuff.
It's Wii Remote Plus with like 150 install base.
So, John has the next email.
Hell's Attack from Massachusetts writes, I'm a huge intelligent systems fan, and I'm primarily a portable Nintendo gamer ever since the N64. I was wondering if you guys could do some Advance Wars 3DS speculation for me. I know Intelligent Systems has a full plate with Fire Emblem being localized and Paper Mario in development, but I was a little upset that you guys didn't even mention the possibility of it being announced at E3. Keep it up, guys. Great show.
Well, guess what? Guess what? It's like we were right not to talk about it.
They're busy, like, I think Intelligent Systems is busy making Echo Shooter 2 for the Wii U.
Well, who isn't busy making Echo Shooter 2 for the Wii U?
I know, or at least an Echo Shooter 2 clone.
Days of Ruin came out, what, like 2008, 2009? So it's been a while since Advance Wars got a release. I think, you know, Fire Emblem did well for them in Japan. It'll probably be a modest success in America when it finally comes out here sometime over the summer, probably. And I think it's reasonable to think that they might go to Advance Wars next after that, you know, but I mean, clearly they were making Fire Emblem and Paper Mario in tandem. So they have multiple teams within Intelligent Systems who make games. But the Advance Wars team is probably the same as the Fire Emblem team, right?
Or are they? Yeah, they are.
They probably are.
Yeah.
So they couldn't really work on Advance Wars until they finished Fire Emblem. And that game only came out a couple months ago in Japan. So I would guess that they're probably, if they're making it, you know, maybe possibly they'll do something in between. But I think it's fairly likely that they just started work on Advance Wars 3DS and we'll see it maybe next year. So I think you can expect it to come out eventually.
So with Days of Ruin never coming out, like in Japan, like is the series not popular over there, or like what's the deal?
No, I don't think it's that. I think it's just more an issue of Fire Emblem's more popular.
I mean, look, Advance Wars is popular enough to have thrived in Japan for about 10 or 15 years before it ever came out in America.
Right.
That series started on Famicom. Mm-hmm. So long before it was called Advance Wars, it was called Famicom Wars, and then it was called Super Famicom Wars. So, and then there was the 64 Wars, but I don't think that ever came out, did it? It was for 64DD. They showed a prototype.
I don't think it ever did.
I remember seeing like screenshots or a video of it, but I don't think they ever finished it.
No, they did not.
Anyway, so it's a very old series. It's got an enduring fan base. You know, Days of Ruin, I don't know why they didn't bring it out. You know, maybe because it sort of lacked the anime thing. Maybe they didn't think it would fly, or it's just maybe one of those weird publishing timing things. I don't know. It was strange.
It's still pretty damn anime.
Yeah. That's a really weird case. So I don't know exactly, but I don't think that series is dead by any means.
No,
it's still,
God,
I mean,
no.
Still plenty popular in America, and it's probably, you know, probably a rabid fan base in Japan who's been waiting a pretty long time since Dual Strike for that game to come back there. So, you know, I think it'll happen sooner than later. What would you guys like to see? I mean, to me, Advance Wars is like, it's a very simple kind of game, so it's, you know, maybe a little bit hard. They obviously try to do something different with it with Days of Ruin. Guillaume, since you played it fairly recently, mm-hmm. would you like them to, like, save any lessons, any of the new features from Days of Ruin, or would you rather they go back to the old style and just kind of perpetuate that?
I liked many of the ideas that they had for the first DS game. What was it called? Dual Strike.
Yeah.
And
back in the DS days, except
I would perhaps like take away the whole like leveling up the CEOs and like the, because like they had, you could give them boosts that would severely unbalance the game. Mm-hmm. So if they could just fix that, I wouldn't mind like seeing those 3D battles and like the duel thing. Like I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm just curious, like what they could do with Street Pass and stuff like that. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, I was wondering, could you do it like chess by mail, where you sort of take a turn, Street Pass? Like if it's someone who you know that you're going to Street Pass frequently, you know, like someone who you cross on your way to work, or mm-hmm. you work in the same building, or it's a family member, then you could play it asynchronously, where you kind of just take your turn. And then you submit it, and then you Street Pass, and then you get their turn, and you see what happens. And that would be, I mean, obviously it would take a really long time to play a game,
yeah,
but if they designed the matches around that mode so that they were shorter, the maps were smaller, you know, something like that, it could be really fun. Or maybe it's just like, you know, collect the most resources or do the most damage in 5 turns, and they just sort of set the number of turns that it could take so that it doesn't take so long.
I would like snap my 3DS in half if like I were into a game that lasted for months and then I lost.
Well, I mean they could do it something like you Street Pass with someone to initiate the game, but then it just swaps your moves over the internet.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea.
Yep.
That's a really good idea, because it wouldn't even have to make you their friend, right?
Right.
Like, you don't, it could be a total stranger. You don't really have to exchange any kind of like personal information or friend codes or anything. It could be like they're your friend just for this one match of Advance Wars.
Yeah.
That's a really cool idea.
That'd be pretty cool if you could just check in, make your move, and then, you know, if the other person made their move, you would just get, you know, some little note.
Right.
And it would say,
right,
hey, you have a...
It'd blink. The icon indicator to blink.
Dual Strike and Days of Ruin have internet play, don't they?
Days of Ruin does, for sure.
But it's kind of simultaneous, isn't it? Like, you have to connect and stay connected for the entire game?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, I believe that is correct. So really, it would, to me, if we're going to do play by mail, it makes a lot more sense for me if it's play by internet. Because you can move your moves back and forth, you know, in non-real time and just pick it up when you have a chance.
Yeah, I agree. So, well, maybe that's something to look forward to. I mean, I'm sure they could do some fun stuff with a 3D screen, you know, kind of like Fire Emblem, where you've got your grid on the touch screen. So you're moving units around that way. But then when you have the battles, you actually watch them play out on 3D screen, and it looks really cool. I mean, I know a lot of people turn that stuff off because, you know, it slows down the game. But if it looks really nice and it's kind of fun and it doesn't look like the same animation over and over again, then it could be, you know, maybe that would be incentive for people to leave that stuff turned on.
Yeah, I mean, for me, whenever I read this question, I just thought back to just playing these games and going, man, this takes a really long time to play with multiplayer. And it just never felt like I had enough time. So that would be massive time savings for me, because it was always like, yeah, I mean, you can turtle in those games and last forever.
Yeah.
So it would make a lot more sense if it was let you basically dissuaded you from doing that.
Fair enough. Okay, so I've got the next email. Cliff writes, I recently saw an article where Miyamoto implied that Nintendo is more interested in making a next-gen handheld instead of a 3DS redesign. He went on to say there probably wouldn't be a second Circle Pad if they were to do a redesign. I know a lot of people have been saying Nintendo will probably add a second Circle Pad to their next handheld, but do you think it's more possible that Nintendo's next handheld might be more focused on simpler games? Perhaps even sprite-based classics, like what made handhelds the Game Boy, GBA, and to an extent DS popular. I think maybe taking away Circle Pads from the equation might be a better move. I like my 3DS, but it feels like I'm playing a home console at times. The thing I always appreciated about Nintendo's handheld was that there seemed like there was a home for classic game experiences. My question is, do you think it's possible that Nintendo would take a retro approach with their next generation handheld, maybe more similar to a Game Boy or a Game Boy Advance experience? I think limiting the controls options by going back to a D-pad exclusive input and forcing developers into making classic games might be a good move. What moves do you guys think they need to take with their next gen handheld?
Wow.
Yeah, it's...
You don't gain more support from developers by taking away features. That's right.
They couldn't have much less support for 3DS right now.
Like, I think that a better way to kind of perhaps encourage the whole like classic gaming thing under 3DS would be A, to release more Game Boy games on the Virtual Console, but also like with a redesign, perhaps make the D-pad a little bit more usable and not so crappy.
I agree with that, but you know, I mean, I appreciate the sentiment here, and I know this is, you know, for 10 years, people have been concerned about the advancing technology in handheld systems and how that was sort of, you know, I remember back when the GBA first came out, people were like, you know, handhelds are really like the last bastion of 2D platformers, and I don't want that to go away with the DS now that it can do polygons. And that ended up, you know, maybe there was a period in there where that happened, but then people found out, oh, the DS isn't actually very good at polygons, and so let's do more 2D stuff and make it just look really nice. Mm-hmm. And that turned out really well. We got a lot of great Castlevania games and Kirby games and stuff like that. And now with 3DS, I think it's even less of a concern because it can download games. And if you look at Mutant Muds, that is a very authentic retro game. You can play it with a circle pad, but you probably shouldn't, and you certainly don't need to. And the fact that the system has all these buttons and a circle pad and motion control and 3D display and internet connection, all that stuff, it basically doesn't use any of that. It's just basically an 8-bit platformer.
Yeah, and like not only that, but like it comes from a developer that used to make first-person shooters on the DS.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. I think because of the new digital distribution platforms, this concern has kind of gone away for most people.
Right.
And I think there's little incentive for Nintendo to make their systems less powerful or less versatile than the previous generation when they can be assured that the ecosystem around these platforms is rich and diverse enough and is supported by enough, you know, developers of all kinds of, you know, different regions and sizes and creative inclinations, that these kind of older, more classic, more simple kind of games are not going to go away, because clearly there's still an appetite. Mutant Muds is supposedly one of the best-selling eShop games. So, you know, and, you know, the one Guillaume talked about in the new business is a freaking pinball game. I mean, it's not complicated. It looks nice, but it's pinball. You know, these kind of games are not going away. They might have, if we were still stuck with everything being a $40 cartridge, then, yeah, that stuff would go away, and I would be really sad about that. But since you can download a game for $5, I just think you're going to be well-served regardless of how many joysticks they stick on it. So that's just not a limiting factor to me.
Until they stick 100 joysticks on it, and then you can't use it anymore.
But, yeah, like, basically the PC would be the most sophisticated platform that you can develop for, and yet on Steam there is no shortage of indie platformers and 2D gaming. Like, it's really, like, they're thriving over there. I think that probably, like, the best thing that Nintendo could do would perhaps, like, lower the barrier of entry for a lot of these developers, because I've heard, like, about how it's really difficult to get your game approved for North America and then Europe.
Mutant Muds just came out in Europe, and it's been out for months and months and months, 6 months in North America.
Exactly.
Cave Story took forever to come out in Europe. So, yeah, clearly they need to streamline this process and make it easier for people to get their stuff out in different regions. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff kind of behind the scenes that can be done there, but that has nothing to do with the design of the system itself.
And to me, the most worrisome part of the email is the concept of forcing developers to make the kind of games Nintendo wants them to make. That's really not a road we want to go back down.
Yeah.
No.
I've seen that road. It sucks. It's got potholes. There's nothing on it. It's just an incredibly unpleasant place to be.
Yeah. Now what I could see, one thing that I've always kind of wondered that why Nintendo didn't do this is maybe not sell a new system, but kind of sell sort of like one-off products, like maybe like a, you know, 10-in-1 sort of game that you could just sell like more as kind of like more as a toy. Right? They kind of went away from that, and I really don't know why they did.
Actually, like, that reminds me, wasn't there some sort of Neo Geo Pocket kind of thing that they wanted to release? It looked like digital downloads and everything. Like, you had a couple of games stored inside, and it looked pretty sleek. And I wouldn't mind something like that from Nintendo. Like, some sort of dedicated... Like, yeah, like, I actually like the idea. Some sort of, like, Game Boy Micro, maybe, but, like, you actually download your games on it.
You know, you could release one of those things maybe once a year. Those things would sell like hotcakes. You know, just say, this is the one for this year, and that's it. Once this one's out, it's gone. We're never going to make another one. Fans would just eat that up. It's like it has, like five games on it. Like, it's a Nintendo 5-in-1. And you sell, you know, you sell that, and there's, you know, you only make 100K of them. And those things would just go, people just go bananas over.
It's a lot better than the John Lindemann 5-in-1. Take my word for it.
I think Guillaume's onto a really clever idea here, because it's kind of an evolution of the PSP Go, right? Because the problem with that is
listen.
The idea with PSP Go is that it would play brand new PSP games, and the problem is there weren't that many brand new PSP games coming out by the time that thing was released, and not all the games coming out were actually available on it because Sony's digital platform is so fucked, and it's not that much better now. And the digital games were more expensive because you could also buy them at retail, except if you buy them at retail, you can't use them on your Go. So it was just a really ill-conceived and poorly supported console, right? But the thing is, Sony, I mean, that was Sony's first handheld, so there is no back catalog of PSP games. There's no pre-PSP for Sony. But Nintendo could go back, make this ridiculously simple, like basically Game & Watch style Game Boy. Like black and white, it's like a Game Boy Pocket or a Game Boy Light, but it's really thin, it's really small, it's basically a screen with buttons and a speaker on it. It costs $15-$20, okay? It comes with Super Mario Land built in, and it has a gig of storage, which is cheap, okay? It costs nothing. And it accesses the eShop, but it can only download Game Boy games. So it's basically a conduit for them to sell a bunch of $3 and $4 black and white Game Boy games. And the hardware costs almost nothing, so there's like incredibly low barrier of entry, right? You could sell it at grocery stores. But it's like, it's this ongoing influx of cash from all these people who can buy very cheap, very fun old games It's you know, very simple to do. And the thing is, you don't have to worry because you can't buy those games at retail anymore. So you don't care if the cartridge works or not, right? It's mm-hmm. only for that. And like John said, like you can release different limited editions of them because they're so cheap. You could actually collect the hardware. You could buy those. Then they could release another one for Game Boy Color and another one for GBA. And it only yep. plays GBA games and it only downloads them, but you don't care because you can only download GBA games anyway. You can't go to Walmart and buy GBA. Right. So yeah. I think this is a really, really clever idea. And it could be like very low price point. The thing is, I mean, right now, obviously their virtual console library just isn't very robust. They couldn't really support something like that. But you can conceive in 5 years, they might have built up enough stuff. You know, I mean, if they could sell, I mean, actually at this point, you probably can buy a Wii for like $50. I mean, used, but mm-hmm. certainly brand new, where they're not much more than about 100. Right. So, even if you never bought a disc for that thing, you could just live on Virtual Console and WiiWare easily. Yep, yeah. There's hundreds and hundreds of games. A lot of them are really good, right? And Nintendo would love that because you're just pumping money into them. And it doesn't matter if the discs are still on the shelves. So I think that is a possibility in the future, for sure.
I'm just salivating right now.
I'd love to see them do it. I mean,
disposable retro platforms.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool idea. I mean, in terms of the main handheld, the thing is, no. I mean, the 3DS is obviously a lot more powerful than DS, and it has the circle pad, and it has motion control and all this stuff. Whether that stuff ever gets used in a really clever way or not, whether the graphics power ever gets pushed, I don't know. I mean, I think Kid Icarus pushes it pretty hard, but it also kind of overshoots in terms of control. But if you look at the PlayStation Vita and the lack of support and the lack of excitement around that platform, it's very, very powerful hardware. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's got an incredible, beautiful screen on it. It's got dual touch inputs, all this crazy stuff, right? And nobody's using it because people aren't necessarily looking for that kind of horsepower in a handheld system. And I think not necessarily exactly what Cliff was writing about, but I think it's worth thinking about the idea of a future in which Nintendo, Sony, whoever is making portable handheld systems at that time says, you know what? We don't really need to make the hardware more powerful this generation. What we need to do is make it smaller and cheaper and improve access for software and make it mm-hmm. easier to develop for. And, you know, maybe that looks like a revision. Maybe that just looks like 3DS Lite. Maybe they change the controls interface a little bit so that it's, you know, and they change the graphics hardware or whatever to make it different enough that it becomes its own separate platform. But it's not necessarily more powerful in terms of graphics and stuff like that. Because I just think at some point, people don't really care. That's not really what people want in portable gaming. You know, I think people want portable gaming. What they don't want is to spend $250, $300 on it, like with Vita, and play mm-hmm. games that cost $50.
Yep. Yeah. It's just way overkill for what people want to pay for it and, you know, how much time they want to spend with it. Because, I mean, everybody will ultimately say, well, you know, how often am I going to actually use this thing? I mean, typically, if you buy a portable, you buy it to use it on the go. Mm-hmm. So
right.
You're not going to buy something. You're not going to buy a 3DS necessarily to sit around your house and play it. You can, but, you know, that's where Sony has fallen short, is the fact that they effectively designed something. They designed a portable game console that is more geared towards sitting on your couch and playing it, which just doesn't make sense.
And like that hypothetical, like, Game Boy kind of look-alike thing would have like such a great battery life. You could bring it anywhere, right? Like it would consume no power at all.
Of course. It's all solid state. Yeah. Just this like, you know, thin film LED lit screen that uses very little power. You know, mm-hmm. it's got some kind of little rechargeable battery built into it. You just plug it into USB or something every 2 weeks, like a Kindle. Hell, they could probably even use, what if they used e-paper for the screen?
Yeah.
With Game Boy, you totally could.
Yeah.
You totally could. The refresh rate is getting up. I would say the refresh rate on like the latest Kindles and Nooks is probably about the same as it was on the original Game Boy screen. Because mm-hmm. that thing really? Had a terrible LCD, right? So you're already pretty much there. And if you made that thing with, because I ordered one of those Pebble watches, the smartwatch, you know, and the watch has an e-paper screen. So it's a smartwatch, which you think, man, that's kind of stupid because the battery only lasts like 8 hours and you wear it all day long. No. This thing, the battery lasts like a week because it's e-paper. It's not really a screen. Now, if you apply that to a Game Boy, You could play that thing forever, and it would it would almost never have to be recharged. That would be fantastic. Now I'm salivating.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It'd be so great. You just make it. Yeah, I mean, you could just make it so lo-fi. Like, oh yeah, like, you know, you can only put five games on it, but you can choose from the entire NES. You know, back catalog.
With the Wii, I think that Nintendo kind of saw the virtual console as a selling point. Do we think? At this point, we don't believe that Nintendo thinks that the virtual console and the eShop...
They sure as hell aren't acting like it.
It's supplementary income at best.
So, like, they wouldn't probably consider it, like, competing with themselves.
Yeah, or, you know, cannibalizing it, but I don't know.
Yeah, like, so I think, like, there could be a possibility there that they do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think at some point Nintendo could probably make a handheld that is... It would have to be a little more powerful than 3DS, but not a lot more. And basically give it access to the Wii Virtual Console library. So, mm-hmm. you know, you still have to buy the games from it, but it could run all these console games on your portable. And they wouldn't have to redo a bunch of stuff. They would just make it so that the emulators run on this portable system. And so now you have this insane walking library of gaming history with you all the time.
Yeah, that'd be great for kids, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of possibilities. I think the future of handheld gaming is, you know, a lot of people are really pessimistic about it in the light of tablets and phones and stuff like that. I think there's still plenty of people who want to play traditional style games on a portable. But I think the future of these dedicated portable gaming systems is not necessarily just more power, more power, more power. But it's also not more motion control. Extra screens. I mean, at some point, the gimmicks, you kind of run out of gimmicks, which is what Nintendo's been doing for the past couple generations. And you just have to say, you know, maybe we should just, like, make it easier to make the games cheaper and more profitable and more accessible, and let more people have a chance to use this the way it's meant to be used. Because $40 3DS games aren't cutting it, you know?
Yeah.
Yep.
James has the next question, please.
Yes, I do have the next question. Nathan in Essex, England, writes, NPD sales figures for 2012 so far have raised concerns about the health of the U.S. console market, with big year-on-year drops in hardware and software sales hitting Sony, Microsoft, and especially Nintendo. There's been some debate over whether this decline is being caused by the natural winding down of the current hardware cycle, or if the console market is now being permanently eaten away by the rise of the mobile/tablet gaming. My question is about what this means for Wii U. Do these weak numbers show a U.S. market that's hungry for a new console, or is the Wii U going to be doomed from the start? Please feel free to respond somewhere between these two extremes.
Well, I do think that there is a big portion of the audience that bought the Wii that won't be back for next generation. Like, they simply won't.
We're on the same page there, buddy.
Yeah, but I mean, so let's say. Obviously, the winding down of the console generation is part of it. I mean, and look at the games that are coming out right now for all the systems. There aren't – we talked about this when we did E3. There's not a lot of games out there where you go, man, this is what game I need to have right now. I mean, it's kind of a slowdown time for all the systems. So
a lot of you know, sequels, a lot of, you know, reusing of game engines, like, you know, like using the Uncharted engine for Last of Us. You see a lot of stuff like that, using the Gears of War engine for Gears of War Judgment.
Right. I mean, I was talking with another staff member yesterday, and we were discussing, after I translated Nintendo's announcement for the Nintendo Direct that was this Thursday. I thought I translated it wrong. Because my Japanese isn't great, and because I translated it to, we'll be discussing Wii news and game, Wii and 3DS news and software. And I'm like, what the fuck are they going to talk about with the Wii?
Kirby.
I was like, Kirby.
Let's not predict, because it hasn't happened as of
yet. No. I know. I'm not trying to predict. I'm just saying, that was my thought process. It's like, what the hell could they possibly have to talk about on the Wii? That console is dead as hell. And so, yeah, the Wii plunging off a cliff isn't surprising at all. I mean, at this point, it's over 10-year-old tech, essentially. And there just aren't any games coming out. And there really haven't been a lot of games coming out for over a year now.
Yeah.
I would say the last big third-party game is Monster Hunter 4. I mean,
Monster Hunter 3.
Think about how long ago that was.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really that surprising. And if you look at the Xbox, it had a bump from Kinect, but that's more or less sort of leveled out.
But James, you're forgetting Just Dance. And I'm serious.
I know, it sold a lot of copies, but still, it's not enough to stem the tide of the console slowdown. You know, it is what it is. We are at the end of the cycle. I do agree that there are people who won't be back for Next Generation, but I think it's just a natural confluence of factors, including economic conditions at the moment, which, even though they're better than they were, you know, a few years back, still aren't great.
I think that's helped these consoles stick around as long as they have.
Yeah, because I don't think there's any real rush to pump out new $600 hardware.
Yeah.
So what happened to all the new gamers that Nintendo created with Wii? I mean, I think
they died.
I think some of them.
They went over to iPad.
Some of them went to iPad. Some of them went to Xbox and Kinect. And some of them said, you know, that was neat, but then I bought the thing, I played it for a month, and then I never touched it again. I'm not going to do that ever again.
Yeah.
I think some people are like, you know, video games are neat, but they're not really my new hobby, right?
Right.
They were like, it was a fad. I saw it at a friend's house. I wanted it, and then I bought it, and I didn't really play it that much. So I'm not going to do that again. But I think those, you know, because the Wii generation went on longer than it should have, let's face it, Wii U should have been released a year ago. I don't know what they would have put on it, but...
with but no games.
They should have, I mean, especially considering the tech that they started the generation with, Nintendo should have pushed to move ahead sooner than they did. And they overcalculated how much money they could make with Wii. I think they tried to squeeze that stone a little too hard, and the milk ran out. So...
Are you mixing metaphors, Johnny?
No, it's an old fairy tale about a giant. And so anyway, you know, I think with Wii U, they have a difficult challenge in, you know, they certainly could try to get some of those people back. I think they believe they also might get new people, like even yet again, get like a kind of a blue ocean effect of getting some people who don't currently play games. The problem is that their message is so much more complicated with Wii U. Because the Wii did one obvious thing, and whether it did it well or not was kind of beside the point, because it did something you'd never seen before, and what it did was easy to show and easy to understand. And Wii U does several things that don't necessarily relate to each other and aren't necessarily easy to show to people. And yeah, I've played it two E3s in a row, and I'm still not really sure exactly what this thing is supposed to be for. I mean, it does multiple things. Whether it does all of those well, I don't know yet. It's hard to say. But, you know, if my parents come and say, tell me about this new system, I would say, well, it's got a screen in the controller. And they would say, why would you want that? I don't have a really easy answer. Well, yeah. I can give them some examples. Some of them are real games. Some of them aren't real games. Some of them, I don't know when they're coming out. Some of them, I don't actually know if they're going to be fun. It's just... it's complicated, you know? It's a complicated system, and it's going to be hard for them to go to a really mass market, which is why I think their supposed strategy that they declared last year at E3 of going after core gamers was really smart, because if they could get it in people's homes at least, then that would give them more time to develop the message and to figure out what do people actually want to do with this thing. It does seven different things. Which one is the most fun? And then they could focus the marketing on that and focus game development on that. And maybe they could come up with a mainstream hit that would really spread beyond the core gamer audience. But so far, you know, you don't have to go very far on the internet to figure out that they aren't really capturing that core gamer market like they wanted to. It's going to be tough.
Yeah. And I mean, and they've actually went completely against that by revealing Nintendo Land, which will pretty much turn off every single core gamer in the universe.
Well, again, Nintendo Land is a bid to get mass, you know, like mainstream people, like non-gamers. Yep. But it's such a complicated product that it's not going to work. It's just not.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it might be really fun, but it's got 12 games. They all play totally different. Some of them require 5 controllers. They have all these complicated rules. Everybody's doing totally different things. It's not tennis. And I think it's going to be hard for them to sell that to mainstream people. And again, the core gamers don't even necessarily want it. I mean, you know, some do. But...
yeah, some do. But I mean, it's certainly not going to bring anybody back to the brand. And if anything, it's just going to confirm what people already think about
my
Nintendo.
My Nintendo Land brings all the boys to the yard.
So, like, what game perhaps would you use as examples? Like, Sing? Or what? Like, to your parents? Like, would you tell them, okay, so this can be a universal remote for your TV, and you can also do karaoke?
That hardly sounds worth $300.
Yeah. Are you sure?
Well, you know, a Harmony remote is like $100.
Yeah, my parents wouldn't pay that either.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll be as good as a Harmony remote anyway.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I don't think any of the games Nintendo showed at E3 will be that sort of killer app for the mainstream audience that clicks, you know. I mean, you can maybe show them Wii Fit U, which might have a few ideas that speak to people, but again, the market has become very saturated with fitness games.
Yeah, we saw like four of them during the Ubisoft press event. I mean,
it's going to be hard for Wii Fit U to really stand out, you know. I mean, the best thing it's got going for it is that you can use that balance board that you already bought that's collecting dust in the closet. It's not a great selling point, you know.
Use that crap we got out of you the first time again.
Yeah. I think they're, you know, it's quite possible that Nintendo could come up with a game that does, it is simple and it makes sense and it's something that I could show to people and they would just get it and they would immediately want a Wii U. But I don't think they've shown that yet. They've shown games that I want, but I don't think they've shown that. I think, you know, they've shown stuff like Mario, which is certainly easy for people to understand and it'll be a lot of fun. You can get people over. You don't really have to explain to them how to play Mario U. But also they're going to play this and be like, can I get this for my Wii? And I'll be like, nah, you can't do that. And they're like, why not? And I'm going to say, well, the graphics are better and you can poke at the screen and put blocks. And it just really doesn't work, you know?
Yeah, I don't think they've shown anything that will really connect with the mainstream audience that they can get into without knowing much about video games.
Right.
They've shown an old man, a little rascal, video chatting with children.
Exactly.
I mean, it turns out that the Wii U is doomed from the start then.
No, I don't think it's doomed from the start. I think it'll do okay with core gamers. It won't be the explosive success that it maybe could have been if they had prioritized the correct games to develop and mm-hmm. if they had explained things and shown things better at E3 than they did. That would have helped. But there's still some time before launch for them to repair that as well. So I wouldn't count it out being a pretty good success at launch. And, you know, the developer support is certainly better than anything we saw for Wii. But again, you always kind of wonder, how long is it going to stick around with Nintendo consoles?
Or are they just trying to monopolize on that opening cycle?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, is anything going to be successful enough that they can actually convince people to come back and make that second game for Wii U?
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, I also think they'll have a hard time convincing people, or, well, it will be their job to convince people that already have a Wii why they should buy a Wii U, why they should re-up for it.
Because we killed it.
That is going to be tough, you know, and especially when, you know, people like Jimmy Fallon don't even fully understand that it's actually a new console, you know, because they haven't even shown the console. Yeah, it's really kind of a mess. But, you know, I think in terms of game sales being down overall, you know, just in general, I think mainly it's just market saturation. You know, mm-hmm. people aren't buying as many consoles because most people already have one or more consoles in the home.
Right.
Yeah.
We're not used to the console generation getting this compacted or this expanded that everybody should have one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's been going on for so long that there just aren't that many people left in America, which is what the NPDs track, who don't already have a system. I mean, if you have ever wanted a Wii, you've got one.
The problem is now, I mean, I think one of Nintendo's problems is the fact that because the Wii has, you know, done such a nosedive the past couple of years, is that people are now saying, well, hey, you know, the 360 is cheap. I'm just going to buy a 360. Because Wii doesn't have anything coming out, and there's a bunch of 360 games I like. So,
the funny thing is, even though the 360 has actually been out for longer than Wii, it looks like an upgrade. Like immediately the visuals, you look at the graphics.
It is an upgrade.
You see Kinect at someone's house. It's like, oh, this is clearly more advanced experience than Wii. So if you are interested in continuing into your pursuit of being a gamer, then buying a 360 for, you know, $150, $200 is a very reasonable thing to do, and that's partly why they've been so successful.
Right.
It seems like an upgrade to the Wii, which is kind of hilarious, but that's basically what Microsoft has positioned it to be, and it's been a very smart strategy for them.
Yep.
Yeah, so exactly what made Nintendo so much money, you know, out of the gate is kind of coming back to kick them in the ass now.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I think a lot of people hailed Nintendo as being geniuses when Wii was, you know, selling out for 2 years in a row, and it was this crazy cultural phenomenon, and now I wonder, like, did they just get lucky? I mean, I don't want to take anything away from them,
because
they made some smart decisions.
Because they got the DS as well.
They capitalized on it very, very well, but, you know, I don't know that they can repeat their success. You know, they've had some trouble with 3DS, and and you know, like, you know, 3DS is selling well, okay? Don't, right. I'm not calling it that it's troubled or anything. But do any of us think the 3DS will outsell the DS?
No, God no, it can't.
Do any of us think Wii U will outsell Wii?
No,
I don't think. But you know, I don't know that any system will outsell either of those systems ever.
You know, that's fair.
Those system sales were absurdist.
You know, I definitely don't think Wii U is doomed from the start. I think its potential is currently, I would say, its potential is limited, and possibly could be expanded depending on what Nintendo does with it. But again, you know, and look, famously, I totally misjudged Wii. I didn't think it was going to be nearly as successful as it was. And, you know, and I understand more about Nintendo and about gamers and things like that since then. But I think the Wii U is just a much more difficult thing to explain and to sell to people. And it's going to be a challenge for Nintendo. I think, I'm not saying they need to strip features out of the system, but what I do think they need to do in terms of marketing is pick one idea and stick with it and focus on that.
Yeah.
And the people like us who really care and are like really into the details, we know that it can also do all this other stuff. But I think they need to figure out what's the best idea we've got for this thing and really laser in on it and figure out how to package that the best possible way and spread the word through that.
But getting away a little bit from like the Nintendo's problems with marketing this thing, like what I'm really crossing my fingers for is that this is going to be in a way like the Super Nintendo to the Nintendo. You know, like the kind of the evolution, like it's not going to sell as many units, but the games on it are going to be better than on the Wii and just, you know, like really fulfilling for Nintendo fans.
I hope so. That's how GameCube was for N64 to me. It was, it didn't really do any, I mean, that was the cool thing about GameCube. Very simple concept. It's a cube that plays games. I mean, it didn't do anything gimmicky or radical. It was the N64, but better. And the games that were on it were just like on the N64, but better. And I would love for that to be the case.
And many of them were the games that were on the N64, but better.
Yeah. So if I can just get like my console from Nintendo that's really satisfying for Nintendo fans, like, you know, like I can't really ask for more. Like, sure, like I understand that they got investors to answer to and like all of that stuff. But if I can get really, really good gaming on this thing, and like it looks like it's shaping up for that, because as I said, I'm really looking forward to Mario. Pikmin 3 looks pretty good. And, I think it's going to be like a really, really solid launch. And if they can keep that up, I'm in.
I think one thing that everybody should keep in mind, because there will be some alarmism over the next year or so with Nintendo.
Oh, really? On the internet?
Yeah. Well, but
there may be trolling as well.
Not just from the internet, but even from, you know, mainstream news, from investors, from, you know, that kind of person.
Well, I mean, honestly, if you told me there was trolling or alarmism from investors, I believe that before you said from the internet.
Sure. But my point is that Nintendo is coming from the largest they've ever been, the most successful they've ever been in 120 years of existence.
Right.
They are going to shrink. There's no way that they can build upon the Wii and actually do even better. I just don't think that's in the realm of possibility. It's a different environment now that they have to compete in.
Sure. Yeah.
So
I mean,
they're going to shrink. Their sales are going to go down year on year. And the number of games and systems that they sell is not going to compare favorably to what they did on the Wii. But that doesn't mean they can't be successful. Right? So you just have to frame your expectations here. I mean, you have to be realistic about what this system can do for the company.
Right. Mm-hmm. And investors are not realistic.
No.
Well, that's the thing. The one thing that Nintendo does very well is that they don't sit there and chase making their investors happy. Some companies
do that. But they have
recently.
I mean,
more recently. But they've always historically shown a willingness to go against the common wisdom of what you should do in the video game space, right? And that's why they've made so much money.
Yep.
You know, because just because you do something that, you know, if you always stick to that safe road of never scaring who's investing in your company, you're screwed because your investors want you to do the safe thing. That's why they're investing in you, you know? But business-wise, that can screw you. So Nintendo's done a good job. So we'll see. We'll just, you know, time will tell.
What scares me is people just freaking out so much about the numbers and, you know, the comparisons to 4 years ago that, you know, we're going to end up with one of these scenes where Iwata is on his knees with a, you know, like a mat out in front of him, and he takes out his DSi LL stylus and he turns it towards his chest.
No, stop. Stop.
I saw that one coming.
Yeah, stop.
Yeah, I saw it.
Okay, so Guillaume, would you mind reading the final email this week?
Ryan from Aragon writes, what do you think the chances are that Pokemon Red and Blue and Yellow will make it to the 3DS Virtual Console? Considering how popular Pokemon is, I would assume it's a no-brainer. On the other hand, with the work it would take to update trading and battles between players, Wi-Fi maybe, it might not be worth it to Nintendo, not to mention the myriad glitches present in the original games. How likely are we to see this kind of re-release? If these games were released, would you pick them up?
It is definitely worth it to Nintendo.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, keep in mind, they really need to implement the link cable anyway, or whatever they used to call that cable.
I mean, if they could do something where you could pass the Pokemon that you would find in those games onto your current.
Oh, no. Cool. They want to be able to resell you those games.
Yeah,
well,
that's way too complicated.
Or maybe even pass them on to the next game.
You know,
you actually used to be able to do, like, when they were actually.
So there was a brief window during the DS lifecycle where you could get all the Pokemons. It has now closed again. So.
Yeah, I think all they're going to do is, I do think they will put Red and Blue, probably eventually Yellow as well. They'll do it later, just like they released that version later. But I think they will put these on 3DS Virtual Console probably, you know, in the next year or so. I mean, you know, there is more work to be done on it. So that's probably why it's taking a little bit longer. But I do think they will do this, and I think you can forget Wi-Fi. That's way too complicated. That requires servers and a bunch of other stuff.
Right, but local connection.
All they'll do is they'll trick the game into thinking that when you connect to someone locally over the wireless, that you're actually connected with the link cable. And, you know, it's a little tricky because the link cable obviously is a one-to-one connection, whereas local wireless, you could be in a room with 10 people who all have their systems on. So they have to put in some little menu where you can just choose the person.
Right.
But once they do that, then they can, I think, fairly easily fool the game into thinking that you're just trading data over the cable, even though you're doing it wirelessly. And you'll still see the awesome little animation of the Pokemon going into the ball, and then it travels through the pipe, and you see the bulge, and it moves over, and it's, you know, and it pops out on the other side. That stuff's awesome. That's part of Pokemon. So that should not be that difficult to do. And I definitely think it is worth their while to do it. They will sell millions of copies of it.
Yeah, but I would think, though, they also won't release it too close to Black and White, too.
And I would also assume that they'll wait until after they've made their retail games available as digital downloads, and, you know, to capitalize on the new users who will be connecting their 3DSs for the first time.
I still wonder if they're ever going to release DS games the same way they're going to release 3DS games. I don't see why they wouldn't.
Yeah, they should at some point, definitely.
Yeah, there's a lot of good reasons to do it beyond the obvious.
But the obvious one is money, which is why they will do it.
But I mean, basically, you could put out games that aren't available anymore on DS. Like, people would actually be able to find copies of, like, Super Princess Peach, which is actually really hard to find now.
So are you guys going to pick up Pokemon if it gets released? Because, like, for me, like, I grew up with a Game Boy, but, like, the first Wario Land was kind of, the system's swan song for me. Like, after that, like, I thought it was dead, and it kind of was. Like, it was resurrected with Pokemon, but, like, I had abandoned it long ago at that point.
I did the same thing. I mean, my Game Boy, I mean, I got the odd Game Boy game, but really, it wasn't until Pokemon came back. That system really has two eras, the before Pokemon era and after. I mean, it became, like, a lot more games came out for that system in the post-Pokemon era.
Well, Pokemon was my first Game Boy game. I never owned a Game Boy till Color, and Game Boy Color came out, like, a month or 2 months after Pokemon Red and Blue, so that was one of the first games I got for it, even though they weren't even in Color.
Yeah, I had one in like 90. So I mean, my Game Boy went for a long time.
Yeah.
But I'm just like wondering if it's worth revisiting at this point for someone like me who doesn't really have any nostalgic feelings for the game. Like, I've already played, I think it was Fire Red, the GBA remake.
Yeah.
And I've got a copy of, like, the gold version for DS that I still haven't gotten through. So I'm thinking, like, I've already got, like, my backlog is already full of Pokemon. Yeah. So I probably... Yeah.
There's nothing for you. I mean,
he's got a pocket full of Pokemon.
There's nothing new in Pokemon. The games are already so similar that if you're having these thoughts, Guillaume, you've already decided. But yeah, the reason they're going to do it is that there are people who want every version of Pokemon that exists, and they're happy to play them over and over and over again. And I think having a digital copy of Pokemon Red and Blue that you can, you know, trade wirelessly, and it's always on your system, so you don't have to keep up with a freaking Game Boy cartridge. Is, you know, and there hasn't been a Nintendo handheld in a while that would even play Pokemon Red and Blue. That's part of why they did the Fire right. Red and Leaf Green. But right. It was mainly for the trading. But that was part of the appeal there as well, is that you don't really want a big gray Game Boy cartridge sticking out of your GBA. I mean, I certainly think, you know, the eShop or the Virtual Console versions of Pokemon Red and Blue and Yellow will only be compatible with each other. I mean, they wouldn't add compatibility with other versions of the game that weren't originally there. But it's enough. I mean, enough people right. will just want to play the original versions, period. Regardless of whether they can catch them all, you know. It's just a nostalgic thing. A lot of people, for a lot of people who are in their, let's say, early 20s right now, Pokemon might have been their first video game.
Yeah.
Think about that. It was such a huge cultural phenomenon, especially among kids in the late 90s with the TV show and the trading cards. A lot of people got their first video game system was a Game Boy or a Game Boy Color, and they're playing Pokemon on it. So, you know, have you ever wanted to go back and play the first video game that you ever played? I know I have. It's called Super Mario Brothers, and I've bought it about 5 times. So, yes, people will buy Pokemon Red and Blue. Absolutely.
Mine was B-17 Bomber. No, I don't.
I mean, I won't buy it because I don't even...
You never played it, did you?
Well, No, Pokemon Blue was my first Game Boy game. I just said that. But I have no desire to go back and play it again. I mean, I've already played it again on Crystal and Pearl and, you know, I've just...
You played Crystal? Really?
Yeah. Well, it was a review copy, yeah.
Oh my god, I don't know anybody who had Crystal.
Yeah, I had the Pikachu version. I believe.
That is Yellow, yeah.
Yellow, yeah.
Yeah, that was the weird version, because, like, all the third versions, usually, they don't really do that much, but that one, like, they remixed story elements and did crazy crap, and I was like, wow, the third one's kind of worth getting, and then the next third one was...
They gave you, like, the permanent Pikachu?
Yeah, it followed you around.
Yeah.
It was bizarre.
Crystal was really weird in Japan. They stripped a lot of stuff out of it when they brought it to America, but Crystal was the first online Pokemon trading
game. Yeah, you could connect it through a cell phone with a dongle.
That's right. There was a special accessory that it came with, but it only worked on, like, a specific brand of Japanese phones or, like, a certain carrier.
Oh, wow.
And you know, it was just one of those things. There was no way in hell they were going to bring that to America. But they stripped it out, they brought it to America, and it still sold really well. So
yep.
That's when they started to realize the very low expectations of Pokemon fans.
It was over at that point.
You know, I don't have that kind of nostalgia for Red and Blue because I've played the later games and they're not that much different. But a lot of people who are really into Pokemon will be happy to do it. So it'll happen. It'll happen. Okie doke. So that's going to wrap up the show. Thank you, everybody who wrote in and everybody else who we have not been able to get to yet. As always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We've also got our t-shirt store on the website, and I hope people are checking that out. There's some really good stuff on there.
I got my olive green Radio for Nintendo shirt, Johnny.
Do you like it?
Yeah, it's very nice.
Awesome.
Very, very nice.
I have not actually seen that one in person.
If I didn't already have one, I would buy one again, you know.
That's the organic one, right?
Oh, the organic, yeah, it is.
No, if you haven't gone by to look at them yet, it doesn't hurt to go look at them, but they're actually some really nice designs on there. They're very high-quality shirts, and it supports the podcast. And there's also connectivity shirts as well. So collect them all, just like Pokemon. We would really appreciate your support. And finally, it's time for the new retroactive poll. So for new listeners, this is the feature, we haven't done it in a couple months, but this is the feature where we play a game together that you've decided upon, and you play it with us, hopefully, And we have a forum thread where you leave your comments on the game, and we will read some of those comments on the show as we discuss the game together. So for Retroactive Edition 23, that's how many freaking times we've done this already.
Wow.
This is going to be a second chance edition of the poll. It's been a while since we did these, like sometime last year. So all of the games in this poll have appeared in previous polls, and they came in second place. So these are games that got a lot of support, but just not quite enough. And some of those races were really, really close. So some of these almost won Retroactive previously. And now they're going to get a second chance. So your choices are, and these are really from a wide variety of platforms and styles. So I think there'll be something for everybody, and they're all pretty interesting choices. So your choices are Beyond Good and Evil for GameCube. Of course, there's also an HD remake of it. That was the theme for that poll, was HD remakes. There's Star Wars Rogue Leader for GameCube, the beautiful launch title. Custom Robo Arena for DS. That was, I was reading through the Retroactive nomination poll, one of the most requested games we've ever had. Custom Robo Arena, apparently it's quite easy to find, and it's out in all the regions. Wario Land 4, that's a GBA game, but it's also on 3DS if you're an ambassador. So a lot of people already have that game. And finally, Fast for WiiWare, the racing game, as the sort of probably the closest thing to F-Zero you'll ever get on your Wii.
By Shinen, and, you know, it's kind of, there's a mix of Ikaruga in there.
Oh, that's right. You're flipping colors. Yeah, and it's from Shinen, so the graphics are really, really, really nice. I think they've already announced they're working on a Wii U game, right?
Try the demo, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a demo. That's right.
That's right. WiiWare has demos now.
That's right. I forgot.
Good thing I'm here.
So those are your nominees. I'm sure they're all really good games. Well, I've played most of them anyway, and I know they're good games. And so it's going to be a really interesting race, and we hope that you'll participate. All you have to do is head over to the forums, and there's a poll there, and it takes 5 seconds. So there will be links to all of these things, links to send your email to the show, links to the t-shirt store, and links to the Retroactive poll, all in the show notes for this episode, and you can find that at NintendoWorldReport.com. I hope you will check it out, and we will talk to you next time on Radio Free Nintendo.
Later.
Bye.
Later.
Muffin.
Hey guys, where's the love? Thanks, Reggie.
I'm gonna let you hear it again. Hold on.
Hello, I'm Scott Moffitt, Nintendo's EVP of Sales and Marketing, with news from E3.
Awesome.
Wow.
I've got
how
news.
Many takes? How
yeah,
many
that's,
takes?
That's exactly the question I was gonna
that
have.
That was about 40th
how
take.
How many takes?
We have news from E3.
The Moffitt Prophet.
Oh, you know the best part, like. What I'm really
the
upset
little Miss
about.
Moffitt.
Oh. So what's upsetting to me is I'm gonna have to watch 2 Nintendo Directs tonight because I have to watch the ones Iwata's in because of his random wardrobe changes.
Iwata,
what?
I mean,
you didn't notice that during the E3 one? Like
his jacket
would just change between cuts. Like the jacket he was wearing would literally just change.
Oh, that's funny.
So yeah, he'd be wearing a suit, then he'd be wearing that leather jacket that he wears, and he's back to the suit. Like it's just like what? What are they doing?
Iwata could very well be an android.
It's like the Oscars.
The weirdest quick cuts I've ever seen.
Okay, let's start. Everyone's recording. Please. Yes, yes.
Yes.
I've got 3
sir.
And a half minutes.
Yes,
of quick
I am.
Cuts.
We're a little chaotic tonight, but we're chaotic lawful. Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, I mean the newest thing they've done with Move is come out with the fancy wheel. The fancy
the
fancy Wii
thing.
Wheel, which is it's one of those. I mean, it's so Sony. I feel like I say that a lot.
It is the Sony-est thing they have ever made.
It's so Sony because it's like okay, a Wii Wheel is perfectly fine. It's cheap. It does what it's supposed to do. But Sony, no, they have to church it up. They have to church it up and give you a Wii Wheel that is so amazing that. It's just so over-engineered. It's
look,
classic Sony over-engineering.
$50 million of research went into that Wii Wheel. $50 million.
Yeah, it's because you want to pay $40 for a Wii Wheel.
They established a whole division to develop that Wii Wheel. Mm-hmm.
All right,
liquidated
I'm going to be cutting this out.
They're the best people on it.
That's hilarious.